Moving forward, lawmakers are awaiting details of a spending report establishing three Ohana safe zones for the homeless here on Oahu, as well as one on the Big Island in Kona. The governor released an outline on Friday on his plan to use $17 million to establish and rehab emergency shelters. That same day, a homeless community on Oahu's leeward coast announced that it received a $150,000 gift to help fund a plan to transition the residents from a tent village to permanent housing. The money came from some of the biggest real estate owners in Hawaii. But as Hawaii Public Radio's Ryan Finnerty tells us, the residents still have a long way to go.
If you're driving up the west side, you'll see Waianae Boat Harbor on the Makai side of Farrington Highway. There are a lot of normal harbor sights, fishermen heading out on the water, and boat owners hosing off their vessels. But you'll also see something not present at most harbors. A stand of kiawe trees on the harbor grounds have become the semi-permanent home for more than 200 people. They're living in tents and improvised shelters, pushed out to the fringes by Oahu's sky-high housing market. The community is formally known as Pu'uhonua Waianae, but its residents just call it the village.
We have about 270 right now. Out of that 270, about 48 of them are kids. Yeah, ranging from newborns to high school. So.
That was Twinkle Borge. She's the leader of the village, part grandmother, part mayor. The village has been here for more than 10 years, always in a state of uncertainty. Twinkle enacted a set of community standards for the village residents. Her goal was to minimize the village's presence and avoid being kicked out of the harbor. But in March, state officials announced they would begin the process of clearing the village from state-owned land.
Well, that's one of the scary parts, you know. I mean, that came to life when we thought that we was going to get swept earlier this year. My thing was, where was everybody going to go? And especially our kids and kupunas, you know.
Twinkle had already been thinking about a more permanent solution for the village, even before the state sweep was announced. But now she knew quick action was needed. She appealed to Governor David Ige, and he agreed to a meeting. At that meeting, Twinkle presented the governor with a plan she had been working on for the past 3 years. Her collaborator was James Pakele. He has a house in Waianae, but frequently volunteers and advocates on behalf of the village.
I kind of followed her around, and we sat under a stoplight, and we started drawing squares on napkins, you know, and you know, it's like, oh, you know, this, we can keep down costs if we do this, you know, we can keep down costs if we can do this, you know, because a lot of times, you know, a lot of focus is always on, you know, how are we going to get these people to make more money, raise the minimum wage, you know, and do these kinds of things. So we tried to kind of approach it from a, you know, the other side of the issue, right? And how do we get by with the money that we have? You know, so, you know, we came up with something like this, which is very, very similar to like a traditional Hawaiian kahale type living system where you had, you know, like communal houses and stuff. So, you know, they had like one hale kuke, you know, that everybody go there and prepare food. And so, you know, and anytime you deal with a whole bunch of people, you know, you kind of resort to communal living. So, you know, Army does it. We did it in Job Corps, you know, prisons, anytime you got a lot of people. So, you know, it's like, why don't we try to apply, you know, that to, you know, to a project that's, you know, kind of just open to everybody.
The plan that Twinkle and James sketched on a napkin was to relocate the village to privately owned land, complete with permanent infrastructure. They presented the plan to Governor Ige, and it worked. He agreed to temporarily allow the village to remain in place. James said it was a surreal moment.
The thing we most appreciated was that he didn't come in with a plan, you know, and he was kind of like open to listen, you know, and just like, tell me, you know, like, let me know, you know, what do you guys want, you know. And luckily, you know, we had a plan. It was just something that we were working on. You know, so, you know, we kind of just explained, like, hey, you know, we understand, you know, that we can't be here for all of eternity. You know what I mean? And we have a plan. And, you know, we just want the opportunity to execute the plan.
But now James and Twinkle had an even bigger problem. Bringing the plan to fruition would take money, a lot of money. James set out to find backers for the project. Not only did they need funding, they also needed professionals who could design the new village. A chance encounter proved to be the critical link.
You know, I went to see a guy about a boat.
Yeah.
I went, exactly. I was trying to talk to anybody who would listen, right? And so somebody told me, oh, you know, go meet with this guy out in Manawili, you know. And so I went to that meeting, and I never talked to that guy too much ever again. But in that meeting, was James Koshiba, that guy. And James Koshiba introduced us to Alani here. and the whole rest of their Hui Aloha crew. and one of there is Mike Hodge, who is a architect, and he's the one that actually did the designs. Because I said, "Oh, you know, I've been drawing stuff on." He's like, "Oh, we can do mock-ups." I'm like, "Oh, really? Okay." You know, and this group right here has just been an absolute godsend. You know, with their individual experiences and the people that they know, you know, they've been able to, you know, connect us to a whole host of other people. You know, it's kind of been a crazy ride, but, you know, I appreciate and, you know, understand the value in building relationships with other people, because there's no way we could have did this, you know.
Now they had a design. They just needed a place to build. An initial goal of $1.5 million was set to cover the cost of land and basic infrastructure.
Phase one would be to, you know, secure land and property, and maybe a little bit of infrastructure and site work, you know, depending on which property it is, you know, to kind of clear them out, and, you know, if you're going to have to run, you know, water lines and, you know, waste lines and stuff like that. We're looking at maybe $1.5 million. Phase two would be where we actually start constructing all the structures and stuff, starting with the communal structures first, so like the Halinoa, the communal kitchen, communal bathrooms and stuff like that.
The group created a nonprofit foundation to raise money and oversee the project. They called it Dynamic Community Solutions, and James was named president. DCS started a crowdfunding campaign and sought out donors, but it was slow going. That all changed about a month ago. A group of Hawaii's largest commercial real estate owners announced a 3-year campaign focused on affordable housing. The group represents some of the most valuable properties in the state, including the Ala Moana Shopping Center, the International Marketplace, and several big-name hotels. The group calls itself REITway Hawaii. REIT is short for Real Estate Investment Trust, which is how most of those properties are managed. REITway Hawaii has pledged to contribute almost $500,000 over 3 years. Pu'uhonua Waianae was selected for a $150,000 donation. Twinkle Borge describes the moment when she got the news.
Even last night, just waiting for it too, there was so much excitement. Like, I would lay down and tell myself, like, who the hell like give us $150,000, you know? But we're doing what we're doing. We set a plan out to accomplish. And let me tell you what, without you, we're going to do what we set ourselves to do. Not just about us guys, it's about generally our people, you know, helping them to get back up on their feet. It's not only about poor Hawaii and I. We want to be able to help the whole island.
Twinkle and James took a page from the public radio playbook. They secured a matching challenge for any money they raise, turning that $150,000 donation into $300,000. But that still leaves a long road to get to their goal of $1.5 million. In the meantime, the immediate challenges of living in Pu'uhonua Waianae continue. James is currently focused on getting dumpsters and portable toilets for the camp, but he's encountering a somewhat mundane obstacle, insurance.
It would be nice if, you know, we could get somebody to give us general liability insurance. I haven't been able to get anybody to call me back. I've talked to several people, and, you know, I guess it's, you know, it's a little bit unorthodox, you know. So, you know, maybe they don't know how to handle it or how to deal with it. But, you know, and it is kind of small, you know, because it would be only on the property that the dumpsters and stuff are on. So, you know, it's not a very big thing. So I kind of understand, but... You know, if we could do that, we would be able to have a dumpster come, you know, actually take the rubbish away. That's one of the huge things, and kind of, you know, one of the first things that I got involved in here. I work for Aloha Trucking, and my boss started lending me the truck, our roll-off truck, and we started coming here. You know, Andrea Tupola, she would coordinate the clearance for H-Power, because H-Power, if you just go in there on yourself, it's like $80+ a ton, and we pulled like 7 tons out of here at a time. So that's you know, so Andrea would coordinate the waivers, so that the tipping fee waivers, so we could dump at H-Power. And, you know, we started bringing in, you know, roll-off dumpsters to help, because that's a lot of people. And the city don't come and pick up the rubbish, you know what I mean? So a lot of times you hear people talk about, oh, you know, the rubbish in here and the rubbish there. But, you know, if the city stopped coming to people's houses, their houses going to soon enough look like that too, especially if they don't have the resources, you know, to take stuff to the dump. And on top of that, you know, this is like 200 and some odd people. Our convenience center here lets people come in, one truck come in twice a day. So you can bring in two loads. That's a lot of people.
It was so hilarious because you need actually a real address to actually get those gray rubbish can delivered to you. So that was like a block for us, but we're learning along the way, you know, and we are learning fast. I mean, like I said, we do have a lot of supporters, a lot of people that come out to also volunteer and help us out, and I'm just blessed for that, yeah.
Among those supporters is Senator Miley Shimabukuro, who represents Leeward Oahu in the state Senate.
Homelessness has become a statewide problem. It's on everyone's consciousness. It's not just a West Side problem anymore. I think that, you know, we as a state have embraced that we need to do something, that this, you know, the housing crisis has hit everyone, every district, every region. I think policymakers would love to see Pu'uhonua be an example and a pilot project for what can be duplicated across the state for homeless encampments that are cropping up everywhere.
Shimabukuro says that state funding for the relocation project is not out of the question. Earlier this year, the state legislature appropriated $30 million for funding so-called Ohana zones for homeless families and individuals. James Pekele says he knows the road ahead won't be easy, but he has no plans of quitting.
A lot of this, you know, we kind of go into and it's like, I don't know how we're doing this, you know, but even if it's, you know, just baby steps forward, obviously this is a huge leap forward. but, you know, like I said, we still got a ways to go, but we're going to just keep trudging.
From the Waianae Boat Harbor, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
If you want to get more information on any of those organizations you heard in Ryan's story, head over to hawaiipublicradio.org. We'll have links posted with the story.
For the best party of the season, look no further than Leche de Tigre in HPR's Atherton Studio. On December 22nd, they're unwrapping their adrenalized Latin percussive rhythms, rock-inspired arrangements, and soulful vocals for you. For admission, go to hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we're trekking over to the island of Kaho'olawe for your backyard quiz. It's the smallest of the eight main volcanic islands, with the land area of about 44.97 square miles. It can be viewed clearly from both Maui and Lanai. Due to the island's low elevation, it receives very little precipitation, often exacerbated by the fact that it sits in the rain shadow of its 10,000-foot-tall neighbor, Haleakala. To make the point about the island's flat state, consider this. The highest point on Kaho'olawe is a crater called Luamakika, and it's only a notch above sea level. For our quiz, do you know exactly how far above sea level Luamakika stands? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, celebrating the arrival of the Daniel K. Inouye, the first of four new ships designed and built for its Hawaii service. Matson.com.
A government shutdown is looming Friday unless Congress and President Trump strike a deal on the so-called wall at the Mexican border. The immigrant issue continues to grab headlines. Senator Brian Schatz calls on the Defense Department to stop any misuse of taxpayer funds to build detention centers. and new details are being released surrounding the death of a 7-year-old Guatemalan child while in U.S. custody. Reports indicate the little girl, Jacqueline McQuinn, died of sepsis despite efforts to save her. The drama's unfolding only heightens the experience of a Honolulu attorney who volunteered this fall to help immigrant families seeking asylum. Renette Kawakami is a professor at the University of Hawaii who offered her services in the Texas town of Dili, about 70 miles out of San Antonio. It's the largest family detention center, and Kawakami was part of a team of lawyers who assisted hundreds of immigrant families who had been separated at the border earlier this spring.
Thousands of attorneys, I think, were volunteering, but it's how do you manage that? So what the Dili Project, pro bono project, had was that a project where you come in for a week with a team of other lawyers from all over the country, and the expectation was you either are fluent in Spanish or you have a Spanish interpreter with you or you have someone available by phone, which really, when you have someone who's translating by phone, it's just not the same. It's much, much more difficult than having someone in person. And you come in for a week from Sunday to Friday, and then you fly out, and another team comes in and helps take over. And what we're doing was mostly after the fact, after families were reunited, and now you have families who are in custody, continue to be in custody, and need to go through an asylum officer and have a basically what's called a credible fear or reasonable fear hearing. They're a little bit different. One is more stringent than the other. A credible fear is a lower standard. A reasonable fear is a higher standard. So what we were doing was helping these moms, these mothers who don't speak English, who are frightened and scared, and some were illiterate, some could not read or write, and helping them be able to communicate to an asylum officer the persecution that they feared back home, whatever country they came from. And that was our job. That's what we did from about probably 7 o'clock, 7:30 in the morning to 6:30 at night. And we were lucky because the week that we were there, there were fewer people coming in. A lot of people were being released, and they think it was in anticipation of what they at that time was a caravan, because we were there at the end of October, early part of November.
And so when you hear all the stories that are in the news and knowing that you had this firsthand experience dealing with that, what are you thinking?
It's heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking to hear about it before we went. It was heartbreaking and soul-crushing to speak to help the asylum seekers, the women and their children. We interviewed children also. Some were teenagers, some were young as like 5 and 7 years old. And it was just very heartbreaking because it's real. It's not like they're making this stuff up. They are fleeing real persecution. They're not big bag criminals. They're women who are like shorter than I am, and I'm 5 feet tall. They're tiny women with tiny children, and they're frail and they're defenseless. And it was wonderful to feel that we made a difference and we helped these women and helped them able to get through their asylum hearings with the asylum officers, and it made all the difference for them. That was good.
So had you done this type of work before, or had this a similar experience like this?
So interestingly enough, I've never done any immigration work at all, never done any asylum work. I am a former public defender for 26 years, so I had experience with interviewing witnesses and clients and being able to be an advocate and how to help people in that way, but I've never done this kind of work. It would have been, of course, ideal that we were if we were trained in immigration work. But what we did was I went through online training that the Dili Project and the Immigration Council provided to all the volunteers. So I had been working on that since July and trying to prepare myself for these issues that I had not arisen in my practice before that. Andres Tobar, who is a third-year student who came with me as a translator and as an interpreter, and thank goodness he had experience in Argentina doing human rights work in Argentina. So he had already some facility with Spanish spoken in judicial terms or in law terms. So that was good that he had that experience. But he had already taken immigration class, so he had probably had more experience than I did in immigration work. But he was fabulous. He was really wonderful. I would not have been able to go had he not come with me.
And so was there any one particular story maybe that struck you of maybe the hundreds that you dealt with?
So it wasn't hundreds. It was probably about 10 or 12, but it took – that's how long it took. Every day we had to work so closely with them for hours. So we maybe saw two clients a day together with their families. Andres spent more time with more people because he had Spanish, because he was fluent in Spanish, he was able to speak to intake, so what they call charlas, and he was able to talk to multiple women, like probably a total of 100 to 200 women at a time, because that was the intake, like explaining to them, this is what's going to happen, this is what we are here for, we're here to help you, just be honest, and things like that, just going through the what to expect when they went to a hearing. So he did actually spend much more time with a bunch of people. He and I spent longer periods of time with individuals and their families. We only saw women with children. That's what we did.
So any one particular family that might have struck you?
It's interesting. They were all, I remember every single one. Their stories are profoundly sad. And I would say the one that probably struck me the most was a woman whose children, whose two daughters were being abused back in Honduras. And, of course, we can't tell you their names. There was no identifying information. One daughter was being sexually abused. The other was being physically abused. And they were basically being used as slaves. Hearing the two girls tell their story of what was happening to them was, I would say 26 years as a public defender prepared me for it, but I was still very moved and shocked. It's something that's going to stay with you forever. And I think that was true of many of the stories that we heard. That was one story. I think another one that was truly, truly, moving was a woman who was indigenous. So she belonged to an indigenous tribe, and that alone caused persecution in her homeland of Guatemala. And her son and her were separated. So they were a family that were separated back in April. They were reunited in July, but they still had not been released. By the time we got back, two Fridays later, we got the word that they had been released and pictures of them at the airport, and it was really heartwarming. This woman was not just persecuted because she was not a good Spanish speaker. Because she was indigenous, she spoke her own indigenous language, and that's what she was fluent in. She was also abused by her father. She had been beaten as a child to the extent that it caused her to be developmentally disabled.
That
added to her difficulties, and both in elementary school, not being able to speak Spanish, not being able to learn Spanish any better. These are very simple, sweet, kind people. It's a difficult process. What people don't understand is that the asylum process is not easy. So even though she may get past this portion where she's being released into the community, she still has a year to then file for full asylum. And that's a hard and difficult process. So what we did was we went through the form with her to help her apply and get the information that's necessary. And the form requires things like, within the last 5 years, where have you lived? Every place you lived. And then within the past 5 years, every place you've worked. And they want the addresses and the phone numbers and the names of your employers. And you're talking about someone who's spent all her life just working as a domestic person. So what she's been doing is cleaning other people's houses. So in a country where I ask her, well, what house? Where is the house located? And it's like, well, it's the house that it's the bottom of a hill near this kind of tree by the bus stop. And there's no address. So there's a town and there's sort of an area, but there's no address for this. And this is the kind of information we had to, you know, dig for and try call back to Guatemala and talk to her relatives to see if we could get more information. And some of that also was difficult because, you know, they're not really sure. Are we really there to help them? We try to tell them we are, and I think for the most part they believe us. But there's also a slight distrust, and they're worried about what's going to happen to their relatives back in Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador. If we call them, will they be on some kind of list? Right? So it was that kind of those kinds of obstacles that we had to overcome. There were like attorneys, there were about 20 attorneys in our grouping from all over the country. There were people from Wisconsin, people from New Mexico. There was a group from the Bay Area. There were people from New York and New Jersey. And we were all together, all working together for the same, you know, good cause. And the very next week, another group comes in. I know there were people from BYU and people from Nevada that were also attorneys that were coming in to help.
So if there's anybody out there listening that is interested in this project,
it's called a Dilley Pro Bono Project. I think you can just Google it, and that's how I found out about it. And also through another Facebook group called Lawyers for Good Government, I found out about that there also. There's Raices, R-A-I-C-E-S. That's another group that they're in San Antonio. I believe they're in the paper or in the news. Part of it is because of their of what happened with a young girl that passed away in the United States government's custody. I think as long as we keep on holding families in custody, I think we're going to continue to need attorneys. And, you know, the difficulty, again, is that you need to be fluent in Spanish or Portuguese, because the majority of the asylum seekers are Spanish-speaking. I think what's really heartwarming is that at one point when I was in Dilley and I was in the facility and I wanted to go forward with another interview, and Andres was busy, and I made calls and emails back home, and instantly I had at least 7 people willing to call in and help and translate. And that was really wonderful. And I recall someone saying that, gee, where they were from, they didn't get that kind of help so immediate and so quickly. And that's the thing about, that's the Aloha spirit, right? People are willing to step in and help out even though they're 5,000, 7,000 miles away.
Well, Renette, thank you. Thanks for sharing the story.
You're very welcome. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
That was UH Law Professor Ronette Kawakami talking about her pro bono experience helping immigrant families seeking asylum from places like Guatemala and Honduras.
Mele Klikimaka and Happy New Year. This is Austin Kino. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Come January 1st, the state's Aid in Dying Law goes into effect. Reporter Brittany Light joins us from the studios of Honolulu Civil Beat for our reality check this morning. Hi there, Brittany.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
So I saw your article says that the state estimates like 40 people might be seeking this next year.
Yes, and that number is taken from Oregon's numbers. So in that state, there are a certain number of people who do this every year. Medical aid in dying has been around in that state for 20 years. So doing some calculations for our smaller population, the state health department thinks that, yes, it could be about 40 people will seek this out in the coming year.
So how are we preparing for this?
Gosh, it takes a lot of coordination, and there are a lot of players. Doctors, of course, nurses and supporting staff, but also coroners, also psychologists. There's a test that patients must pass that shows that they are mentally capable to make this decision to have medical aid in dying. There are also pharmacists, and there are some big questions there. Right now, there are two drugs that can be used for medical aid in dying, and right now none of the pharmacies in Hawaii seem to carry those on a regular basis, and it's not clear which ones will decide that they will carry them and which ones perhaps won't. So there are a lot of open-ended questions here.
Now, your story, in your story you talked to a retired doctor, a Kaiser doctor, who's going to come out of retirement to help with this?
Yes, Dr. Charles Miller. He goes by Chuck, and he's very passionate about this law. He helped lobby to get it passed, and now that it has passed, he's coming out of retirement for a year to work at Kaiser and be the go-to guy for patients who want to go forward with medical aid in dying. And he's hoping that during that year he can sort of, as he says, work himself out of business. He wants to spend a lot of time educating the other physicians there, helping them to maybe feel a little bit more comfortable with a method of treating patients that's very, very new in this state, but in other states, you know, has been around for a while. So he's trying to get people more comfortable.
Yeah, and your article has a quote where he says he's seen thousands of cancer patients die over the years. But he really wants to help folks going forward.
Exactly. So a lot of people feel that medical aid in dying is a choice that patients should have and deserve to have. Dr. Miller goes so far as to say he believes it's as much of a right as anything else in the Constitution to be able to choose when you want to die, how you want to die, where you want to die. But of course, there are others who, particularly folks who are of certain religious faiths, believe that, you know, this isn't in our hands. We shouldn't be meddling with when we're going to take our last breath. So it's controversial, and it's clear that although the state is encouraging hospitals and hospice centers, et cetera, to be neutral, it's clear that some facilities will not be neutral. There are some facilities that oppose this and are not going to allow medical aid in dying on their facility, while others are actually going to be a little bit more active, a little bit more than just neutral. They are going to, you know, actively let people know that this is an option that's there for them.
And I'm sure there's still going to be lots of education that needs to go hand in hand with this as this gets opened up.
Yes, it's clear from me. It's clear to me that from doing this reporting, there has been a lot of work done to try to get roll this law out in a way that's as seamless as possible. But everybody admits that there are some gaps and some unknowns, and it's really not going to be clear what those hiccups are in the process until the first patients go through it. So it's sort of, you know, you have to learn as you go a little bit when it comes to a brand new law like this.
Right. Important issue. Good story. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was reporter Brittany Light with today's Reality Check. To read her full story, visit CivilBeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
A Mililani man who started collecting signatures on a petition to remove City Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro from office because of malfeasance has managed to get more than 800 people to put their name to the online drive. But Tracy Yoshimura says while the law is vague about what happens next, he plans to drop off copies of the petition to a number of government offices today. Yoshimura faced gambling charges over sweepstakes direct machines that were seized by the city years ago. Those charges were later thrown out. Yoshimura believes he was unfairly targeted, even though he wrote to the state and city before rolling those machines out. He says his case is making its way up to the Hawaii Supreme Court.
Because nobody seems to have a definitive answer, you know, as how this process is, you know, specifically supposed to move ahead, one of the moves we're going to do is to drop off a copy of the petition along with the signatures to the governor's office, to the attorney general's office, to the mayor's office, to the city council, and to the clerk at the circuit court. And I mean, that way there, every agency is fully aware of what's going on, and if it's within their responsibility or wherewithal to do something, that we know that it's there, and nobody can come and claim that and say that we weren't aware of this. So we're putting it out there to get in front of everybody so that everybody can take a look at it and help us to get direction.
You initially were going to try to go to the Supreme Court.
Yes, because the city charter, or the information that we're getting, is that that's where it had to go first, to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court would then send the signatures down to the city clerk for certification. We were notified by other people looking into this that there's a Hawaii revised statute, which now is on the state side, that dictates that it goes through the circuit courts. But other than saying how the petition needs to be started, just roughly saying that it takes 500 signatures to initiate the process, and one the city saying that it needs to go to Supreme Court, the state saying it goes to circuit court. Other than that, there's really no specifics.
Okay, so it's not as easy as you might have thought to get this thing filed.
Yeah, you would say that, yes.
Okay, and then
I would agree with that.
One of Keith Kaneshiro's first deputies has stepped aside during this probe. Do you believe Keith should do that too?
Without question, as well as Jan Futa or anybody that gets caught up into this, because the potential is there that this could lead to a conviction or other type of law enforcement reprimand, which raises issues about their credibility or integrity that the defense lawyers will use, just by the mere possibility that they could be convicted or found guilty of wrongdoing that would threaten the legal status of any and every case in that office that ever has been there that these prosecutors have touched or have been under the supervision of Prosecutor Kaneshiro. That is a tremendous threat to the public for, two things. Cases could be dismissed, active cases. Cases that have been wrong done could be overturned. Criminals could be released to prison, from prison out to the streets. And then the financial cost with all these cases be challenged is absolutely astronomical. But the public threat is the main thing of having, these dangerous criminals out on the street set free to roam and threaten people's lives and, well-being.
We've been talking to Tracy Yoshimura, who started an online petition to begin impeachment process against City Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro amidst reports that he and two of his top deputies, Chastity Cipolla and Jan Futa, have received letters from federal law enforcement that they're being investigated. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with Christopher Phillips and Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
It's Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips, and we've got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's in store this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus in the eastern sky before dawn and Mars in the evening sky after sunset. It'll be in the west. Both planets are bright and should be very easy to spot. The moon this week is passing through its full phase, meaning that stargazing for those faint objects in the heavens is going to be very challenging indeed.
You often have a lot of mission-related stories, and I understand you have a kind of a wild one here, an asteroid rendezvous. Do I have it right?
You do indeed. Now, all the talk recently has been about Mars with the successful touchdown of the InSight lander. And with all this fuss, it's easy to forget that we have a whole host of robotic explorers out there in the solar system. One of these intrepid explorers is OSIRIS-REx. It's a probe that was launched in 2016, and its mission is to return samples from a near-Earth asteroid called Bennu. And this week, OSIRIS-REx arrived.
What is a near-Earth asteroid?
Well, these are a family of objects that cross the orbit of our own Earth as we all go around the Sun. They're not necessarily dangerous, but they are well worth keeping an eye on for future reference. The ones that are dangerous, though, are the ones we haven't found yet, because there are many thousands of near-Earth asteroids out there.
And this thing landed on it and took a little piece and brought it back to us?
Well, it's in the process of doing that, and it's going to bring back just a few grams of asteroid material, but what we can learn from that is huge.
And what you're really saying is you don't need a whole lot of it to make the determination of what of the kinds of things you're looking for.
Exactly.
And when it comes to these near-Earth asteroids, one might obviously wonder, does somebody keep track of these in terms of protecting the Earth from them?
Well, right now there are several observatories in Hawaii that routinely look for near-Earth asteroids. They are the NASA IRTF telescope atop Mauna Kea and the Pan-STARRS telescope atop Haleakala. In a few years, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope in Chile will also start to identify these objects. So we are getting there.
And those samples you're talking about, when's the touchdown, Chief?
Well, OSIRIS-REx is scheduled to deliver its precious cargo to Earth in around 2023.
Well, that's a long haul. Well, we'll be waiting for that one. Christopher Phillips, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week on Stargazer. We keep Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Mele Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Robert Casimiro. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, the Seminary of the Southern Baptist Convention, America's largest Protestant denomination, took an honest look at its own history and now is apologizing for its deep ties to racism and slavery. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
This morning, we trekked over to Ko'olawe for our backyard quiz. It's the smallest of the eight main islands, and its land area is measured at only 44.97 square miles. Long ago, Ko'olawe was a place used by Polynesians to train in the art of celestial navigation, using stars as a navigational guide through the ocean. This remains true to this day. The island is still used by its reserve commission as a location to teach techniques for navigation without the aid of instruments. The highest point on Ko'olawe, and probably a great place to look at the stars, is where the Lua Makika crater clocks in at 1,477 feet above sea level. And congratulations, Billy, who called in from Kauai, you got it right. That's today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Tomorrow will mark 8 months since Kauai residents suffered millions of dollars in flood damage. Our Ku'uwei Hiraishi is on the Garden Isle this morning and joins us with an update on the recovery. Hi there.
Yeah. Aloha, Catherine. So, I am in Hanalei right now. This is as far as you can go on the road up to the North Shore. But right now I am in the portion of Hanalei Bay where you've seen those homes. Folks have been following the flooding and damage. The homes that are still sort of haven't been removed. They're damaged, and people can pass by and see them, but they're on a portion of the bay that's currently closed to local traffic only. On the other hand, I can see the pier from here and also the beach, and it's packed. It's packed with tourists, packed with locals. There's a lot of people here, and folks here are saying it's because of that overflow from having the rest of the road closed up north to Haena and Ka beaches.
Oh, interesting.
It is. I got to speak with Joel Guy. He's the president of the Ha'ena and the Hanalei Community Association, about what's beyond. So at the end of Hanalei Bay, right before Wai'oli Bridge, there's also, that's where the road is closed, and no one, except for those who live in Ha'ena, Wai'niha, all the way out to the North Shore, only local traffic can go beyond those barriers. So I haven't had my chance yet to get beyond that. I will later today, but I did talk to Joel Guy to get an idea of what it looks like beyond that. Here's what he had to say.
Much destruction still there, and the road itself is actually, it's so, the infrastructure has been so pounded over the years, I think just from humans. I think we all notice that there's been a huge impact to the visitor industry out there. And I don't think that's unique to just that area. We know that other areas of the island feel this effect. In that area, the road was already so fragile, and it was already getting thousands and thousands of cars every single day out there. So the flood allowed us to, it busted up all the hillside. There's miles where you couldn't get to, and now you can do one lane. They do have one lane available, and they convoy cars in and out every day at a certain time. And so that system in itself is, a mental stressor on humans out there.
Yeah, so that convoy system is what a lot of residents that currently live in Ha'ena and Wai'niha, but work in town or on this side of the road closures, that's what they experience on a daily basis. And this convoy schedule, from what I've heard, is sometimes hard to adapt to. They've got to cut appointments short. They've got to try to get their kids out of school really quickly or cut those meetings short so that they can make the convoy, because if not, they are stuck on the other side of the road closure.
Wow, sounds like they really have to have a lot of patience.
They have, and like you said, it has been a little bit stressful for folks who are doing that commute, but it's been going on for, the initial idea was to have it just happen for 6 months to allow for this sort of transitional period for folks to get their homes together, and then they would open up the roads again. But road repairs have taken a little longer. They're still working on them. Last update from Hawaii State Department of Transportation was that early next year would be the target date for reopening the road, just one lane, but opening it up to the public. And so I wanted to get a sense from the folks like Guy about how they feel about reopening this road to the public. And so this is what he had to say.
Yeah, that seems to be the moving target that we've all been trying to deal with, is how do we, when will the road open? And then once it's open, what does that new normal look like, right? Is there any way we can put a system in place that allows the majority of visitors to be brought out there via shuttles? And you could bring them to, the economic engines out there. Opakapaka is a business hub. The two lifeguarded beaches out there, that we have infrastructure, we have bathrooms and lifeguards, and really create a, treasure that area and really make sure that we care for the people, that we bring them out there safely, and we bring them to places that are cared for, that they'll be cared for. We don't let them just, people just running all over and thrashing all that area. There's just way too many people. And like I said, I don't think it's unique to there. I think we feel these effects around the state.
Yeah, so thousands. I think a community group had done a count of how many cars go in and out of Ha'ena Beach or right at the end of the road, and it was something like 3,500 a day, rough estimate. And so in the community trying to figure out what that number should be, an initial state park plan for Ha'ena, a master plan, put the number at 900. So they were saying, we think that the natural resources and the roads and the infrastructure out here could handle as many as 900. Let's try that. And so this idea of a shuttle service, which... Guy's group, actually, he ended up out of this recovery effort, was able to start a nonprofit called the Hanalei Initiative and garner up some money from Kauai County, who he said has been very supportive of recovery efforts that the community wants. Specifically, got about $1 million to start a short-term shuttle service that'll take folks from Pinchville out to Ha'ena, and it's going to start, actually launch this Thursday.
Right. I know that there was a concern about over-tourism and, if anything, the closure of the roads has really given probably that natural resource area a chance to kind of breathe and heal.
Definitely. The natural resources and I think also the people seem to be a lot more, you know, the residents out there aren't as frazzled by over-tourism right now. But I had one last thing to say about what you just mentioned, Catherine, that idea of getting this restart, getting this sort of clean swipe of having no tourism out there and figuring out how to move forward. This is what Guy had to say.
You know, it was so many people prior to the flood, and you couldn't have dreamed for a better scenario as far as trying to, you know, get your hands around this challenge of over impact of the visitors, right? It's impossible to go from that number down to 900. But if you're going from zero up to 900, that's a much easier thing to attain. And we get much more support from HDOT, state parks, county, and the community. We all kind of get on the same page to say, look, that was too many. Now we have zero. We can come up to an amount that is actually comfortable for everybody.
Really interesting.
Yep. Yeah, I'm gonna hope to talk to more folks out there that are on the other side of this road closure today, which should be interesting to kind of see what everything looks like on the other side. And we'll hopefully have that report back up this week.
All right, can't wait for the stories. Thanks, Kuvehi.
All right, mahalo, Catherine. Aloha.
That was HPR's Kuvehi Hiraishi checking in with Kauai residents on the flood recovery. For her stories, go to hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Frederick Douglass. We speak with historian David Blight, whose new biography of Douglass is on many best of the year lists. Douglass's speeches about his escape from slavery and the abolition movement were so popular.
Seeing and hearing Douglass became, through the course of the 19th century, a kind of American wonder of the world.
Join us
this afternoon at 3.
We do have to go, but up tomorrow, Trash Talk. We take a closer look at a report on littering, and the Veterans Undersecretary talks progress in helping improve the care of our vets. We'd like to hear from you, be it VCare, VA care, or littering. What bugs you? Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's a number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, go to our Conversation page. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.